Welcome to the Boomer Woman's Podcast. I'm your host, Agnes Knowles. Chronic pain. Many of you deal with it daily. My guest today understands the pain and the fear and how it can control so much of your life. DK connects the dots between the physical, the mental, and the emotional realms in dealing with pain. She also discusses stress resilience. Many of us, yes, me included, have been told to deal with our weight to handle an injury and the associated pain. DK's practice is weight neutral. Strength, balance, flexibility can be improved no matter what your weight. Listen now. My alarm goes off almost every morning at 6 a.m. I could sleep a bit longer, but I love my quiet hour with my coffee and my tablet before facing the day. Almost every morning when that alarm sounds, I stretch, roll over, and click it off. Then go through my routine of leg rolls to wake up the hips and lower back, arm stretches to get the shoulders limbered up, and then one long stretch before I roll over to reach for my slippers. The rolls and stretches aren't completely necessary. Maybe. But I do know that on those mornings when I decide to climb straight out of bed, I have my fair share of aches and stiffness, and I'm definitely moving more slowly. It's a product of age, and I'll admit it, a lack of more strenuous activity this last year or so. Are you identifying? Commiserating, maybe? Well, maybe you'd like to meet today's guest. Dana Karen, we can call her DK, comes with lots of credentials, and she brings a unique, multifaceted approach to managing pain, emphasizing the critical connections between the physical, mental, and emotional realms. I'm looking forward to hearing more. DK Ciccone, welcome to the Boomer Woman's Podcast.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
DK, before we start, I read in your profile that you have a master's degree focused on global health policy. Yet here you are in Boston helping us conquer chronic pain, increase stress resilience, and reclaim an active life. Why aren't you working with the World Health Organization?
That's really funny that you should ask that because I purposely chose an international program in Geneva because I had a dream of working at the World Health Organization.
Oh my goodness.
So I have, in fact, worked at the World Health Organization, both as an intern and then later as a contractor. And then I've gone back during I was working for a time at the Yale School of Public Health, and I went back for, to give some talks on different research we were doing. And the short answer to that question is that I found more personal fulfillment working one-on-one with people and seeing that they could make demonstrative improvement in their own lives than banging my head against a wall every day, hoping the system was going to get better. And that's the reality of sort of where I landed with my frustrations with the international policy arena. But I always leave a little bit of room, and just in case I end up finding my way back there.
Okay, well, I identify that's the reason, one of the reasons I'm not a social worker today. Now, your journey with lower back pain started early. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so it's funny. In the process of writing my book, I really had to go back and kind of process this moment where I was 13. And it's the first time that I can recall having a really debilitating back pain experience where I was on stage in the middle of a performance of a musical called Godspell, maybe familiar.
Yeah.
And I really did something very simple with my body. It was nothing, it's not like I did a backflip or something. And I suddenly just had like all I can really think of as sort of a lightning bolt sort of feeling that made me feel sort of rigid from head to toe. And it just it I made it through that performance, kind of gritting my teeth, and then spent the rest of the weekend on ice packs and heating pads and trying to get what we assume was a muscle spasm to calm down so that I could move. Like I really felt like I couldn't bend my spine or twist my spine. And of course, singing and taking a deep breath was painful. I mean, it was just all over my low back to mid back. And that just kept happening. And it's interesting because I don't think I ever really questioned it until like now, going back and thinking about it. Boy, my parents must have been really confused. I mean, it's not like I, had an accident or something, that would have caused that amount of pain, but it was pretty life arresting when it happened, and kind of continued into my 20s and morphed into different kinds of pain in my hip and elsewhere. And it just basically, I felt like I had been an, I'm an only child, and I feel like pain became my bratty younger sibling that I took with me.
Now, do you think part of that could have been just because it was a growing body that wasn't fully developed?
Yeah, I've met a lot of, so in the course of doing this, like I've met a lot of folks who've had sort of different perspectives. I do think that there's probably an element of anxiety that was happening early on. I do, now have anxiety issues as an adult that probably were starting in my childhood. I think that as a dancer who was training multiple days per week, I probably was, putting a lot of strain on my body at a time when it was, developing. I was certainly starting to really peak into puberty at that point. And, there's lots of research now that sort of show how kind of vulnerable our bodies can be at that age. And in dance, you're kind of pushing yourself to the limit. I think I probably have some anatomical predisposition to challenges just because of the way my body is structured skeletally. Yeah, so I think it was just a perfect storm, I really I still to this day like don't have like a perfect explanation for it.
Super hard on a young teen, though. Did you find resilience at that age, or is that something you've sort of learned over the years?
Yeah, well, thank you, first of all. I would love to think of myself as resilient. I suppose I feel like it's a journey. I wish for another tenth of more resilience every day. No, I don't know that I did. I mean, I think I was really scared. I think I had just a reaction of fear. And I do think that like that was kind of part of my nature as from a young age as well, was to be a little fearful. I think I've always been sort of fearful, cautious, like I was not the kid to go flowing like throwing myself off the monkey bars, to do a big thing. Like that was not me. And as we know now, like fear is sort of the fuel of pain. And so I think in some ways that probably perpetuated a bit of a cycle where I had a situation where I was under a lot of pressure. I went to sing. It was a solo. I was singing a solo when it happened. And it was kind of a big deal because it was my first time in a community theater production where I was in a significant enough role where I was singing by myself. And I'm sure that all the adrenaline, the sympathetic nervous system was like, all the tentacles were up. And so I think I probably slipped into sort of this cycle of like being under pressure, having adrenaline, and then having a fear reaction, and that sort of perpetuating the danger signal. Because ultimately, pain is the brain's way of letting us know that it believes that it detects danger to our physical being, right? So if you can very easily slip into a self-fulfilling prophecy where you fear the pain and then the pain happens and then you sort of confirm your bias about that thing, that it's going to cause you pain. And it's very easy to get stuck in that.
Little hamster wheel thing. Yeah.
Correct, yeah.
So are you relatively pain-free now, or have you learned how to live and keep moving with pain as a companion?
Yeah, so it's definitely better. I think I have to look at my life holistically, and I've learned to, and this actually goes to the resilience piece of it. I've learned that the resilience for me comes in being able to recognize my precursors to a flare-up. So I can't push myself to the nth degree and expect that my body will not react with some kind of a something. So getting enough sleep, like if I feel like my fatigue is really starting to kind of take over, I need to listen. If I'm starting to feel overwhelmed at work or, having, maybe difficult relationship things going on or job things going on or stressful life changes or whatever, I really try to tune in carefully into how my body is experiencing that and what it's telling me. Because if I don't listen, it's a surefire way to end up in a pretty significant flare-up. That being said, I think my body feels better, and I often say it feels better in my 40s than it did in my 20s or 30s because I've actually started jogging again for the first time in like 15 years, where I really just didn't believe that that was like a thing I could ever do in my body. And I think what has helped me the most is really kind of methodically taking every one of those theories that I held about certain activities and the pain that they were going to cause, and really trying to dismantle or prove like that that was really a true assumption. And a lot of the things, and I know you had someone recently talking about lifting weights. Lifting heavy weights is one of them. I mean, I enjoy lifting heavy weights. I believe it's important for, muscle strength, but also I like the feeling. And I had given it up for quite some time because I went through a period where clinicians told me, not to bend at the waist with any load, which it turns out you can't do your life really. So like that was not helpful. Sometimes you get advice and you're just kind of looking back at it. You're like, how exactly does that work? Like, someone gonna
Never
pick up
brush your
my
teeth again.
laundry? Right, exactly. So, kind of dismantling that, I think when, especially when a white coat tells you, it's kind of hard, like you really feel like you're acting a rebel to question that kind of advice. But I've actually found now that lifting heavy and really actually keeps me out of a pain flare up for whatever reason, keeping those muscles strong, like helping to balance out the tension in my body, also maybe keeping a mindset of strength, managing my stress. Like there's many reasons why that could be effective. But like, I've had to kind of systematically look at all the things I was afraid were going to cause pain and kind of figure out what exactly was true about them or not. And as a matter of fact, I would also, give a plug for pelvic floor physical therapy, which was also really helpful, and I think something we don't always recognize as could be a part of the whole all over pu puzzle for low back.
That podcast episode goes live next week.
Oh, really? Is that true? Oh, how cool. See, I give you a
Oh, dear.
perfect plug.
There you go. So, as you're saying that, I'm thinking that perhaps one of the cornerstones of resilience is that self-knowledge.
Oh,
Of,
100% it is.
yeah. And correct me if I'm wrong, but rarely does a muscle work in isolation. So, by staying overall strong, there's other muscles that can help support any area that's weak or compromised.
Yeah, I think we have sort of we have developed this maybe tribal knowledge that, believing that you can sort of hone in on one muscle and make that muscle kind of strong by itself. And that's rarely true, like you said. I mean, the human body is an efficient machine, so it really calls on everything. And the idea and part of why I think Pilates is so special is we're trying to prepare people for the kinds of movements that take you by surprise, because that's actually where you end up in trouble, right? Like you want to be prepared for the slip, you want to be prepared for not catching your feet on the stairs correctly or picking up something heavier than you were expecting, and so that's where I think we can really kind of protect ourselves.
Love what you're saying because, like, well, that's 2 weeks from now. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of,
I
yeah,
love it.
that's just coming together here. This is great.
Amazing,
Now,
amazing.
as a practitioner, you connect the dots between the physical, the mental, and the emotional realms in dealing with pain. And that's the road I'd like to start with today. As boomer women, we've had many opportunities to encounter the pain. And as years go by, it certainly affects us mentally and emotionally. Is there an actual physiology of pain, or is each person's pain their own thing? I don't, I'm not putting the words together.
Yeah, so I mean, at its most basic level, your pain is a is something that is within the nervous system because the brain, historically, and I always try to start also with like helping people understand that pain is actually a really good thing. And I think that that was hard for me as well in the beginning to kind of swallow, to say, oh, pain is actually a sign of my nervous system functioning correctly.
Okay.
Because evolutionarily, if we stepped on a nail and didn't have discomfort because of the infection, like we probably would have died from it, right? So it's your nervous system responding to some kind of sensor in your peripheral nervous system that tells it that something's happening. It's sensing a heat change or a mechanical change, and it's sending that information, and the central nervous system says, interprets what's going on and then thinks danger and then sends pain. So that part is consistent for every human, but it becomes a much more complex picture once, we put that human into the environment, because your nervous system first of all, will have different levels of threshold of sensitivity. Like I think I'm a high sensitivity person. I think that's consistent also with my anxiety diagnosis. where, loud noises or sense, really sensory dense like situations will kind of make me feel overwhelmed. And so I just, as a kind of a personal hypothesis, I believe I'm just more sensitive to having a pain reaction because I'm more likely to sort of see things as a threat that might, a person who isn't really bothered by tons of lights and sounds and noises and everything, they might not feel threatened in their body, and therefore the pain response is not going to come. So there's sort of your that threshold of sensitization that you're born with, like that I think will go with you throughout time. But then there's also like what has happened in your lifetime. Like if you've had experiences in your childhood that have informed you that the world is an unsafe place, you're more likely to then believe you're unsafe. And then again, that pain reaction from the brain is more likely to be triggered because it's always because it believes you're in danger. And it's not always correct, right? It's your like most primitive part of your brain. And it doesn't really understand the difference between a tiger literally chasing you and your boss yelling at you about a report that that they didn't like. They're both tigers as far as the brain's concerned, you know what I mean? So, and then if you've been through like, something really traumatic, like a car accident or a really bad fall and a break at a key point in your life, you may kind of find that even ages after that's healed, your pain returns in that area when you have a really high stress event in your life. So I often have people come to me and say, "Oh, I have an old high school injury that hasn't healed, and it's really bothering me lately." And we'll kind of go into, "All right, well, what else is happening in your life?" And it's like, "Oh, well, I'm going through a divorce and I just lost my job," and you know what I mean? And I'm like, I think it's really unlikely that like the, ACL issue from your, high school soccer days is what's like suddenly deciding to be mad, right? Because the tissues have long since healed. But it's more likely that there's a memory of a traumatic event there that's just being sort of triggered by other things that are going on in your life. Like we call it this biopsychosocial model of pain, which takes into consideration what's happening in your relationships, what's happening in your tissues, what's happening in your environment, and then kind of who you are at this stage. And I do think part of what happens is that, unfortunately or fortunately, like the process of being alive leads to more bumps and bruises emotionally and physically along the way, right? So like if you live a long and rich life with impactful experiences, like some of them are going to hurt, some of them are going to cause stress, some of them are going to trigger fear. And so I think it becomes more difficult to keep that cycle at bay, that spiral at bay, as we have identified more threats. Like I wish I could say that as I get older, the world feels safer. I don't know anybody who's like feels that way, honestly. So yeah, it's like, what do we do with that learned behavior, and how do we keep ourselves feeling as safe as possible, and how do we like keep our nervous system from overreacting? And I think that that is a little different for every person. And for you, it sounds like you have a kind of a ritual of a morning routine that's probably both just beneficial for your circulation and your bones and muscles, but also has kind of instilled in you a sense of like, when I do this, my body feels stronger, safer, more capable. And I think that's like really great that you start your day with that kind of, reminder of your physical body of what it can do.
Well, maybe it's information that I've come by the hard way, but I was going to say I've got a really high pain threshold, and there's been more than once where I've gotten into a position where it's like, well, damn, that wasn't the smartest thing. I should have stopped, this however far back. But I'm just going to go somewhere else now. You say that diet culture makes us more susceptible to pain. Can you explain that?
Yeah, that's again sort of an N of one. Well, that's not really true. I have, as the clients I've worked with and myself, I've just seen this pattern. And I believe that there is an association here. So I wouldn't say that it's like peer-reviewed research material. So that's my disclaimer. But I really believe that, especially at the time that my initial pain flare happened in when I was 13, you think of what a vulnerable time that is in a woman's development. And I was also so in love with the idea of being a dancer. And I was not born with classical dancer body. And I was already very much restricting at that age, and probably not, that probably also wasn't great for my like development and muscle development. because I was doing it in like a pure, just don't feed, just starve the body kind of way. And I have worked with several people who have had this history of weight cycling and feeling basically like they can't trust their bodies to be what they wanted. And then also later on developing chronic pain. And there's certainly enough research out there talking about adverse childhood events and chronic pain, or just other stressors and trauma and chronic pain. And when you think about you just kind of from a logical perspective, the idea that pain really originates from this feeling that your brain believes you are unsafe. If you don't believe your body is like a safe vessel to be in, like you have, I have to imagine that that's going to affect your general sense of safety kind of in your environment. And I can say also that what, like you mentioned before, how resilience really requires that you have a profound self-awareness. Because unless you are sensing what your body is trying to tell you, like you can't take the steps that are needed to intervene in a spiraling of the sympathetic nervous system or kind of becoming triggered into fear or whatever. And diet culture only teaches us to shut off our body, like our connection between our brain and our bodies. Because if if you are telling yourself the thing that the growl in my tummy isn't real, you're sort of teaching, you're telling your brain, like, okay, whatever my body is telling me, this signal is not accurate. And so I believe we sort of lay the groundwork for chronic pain later, because then when things are trying to let us know that they need to be addressed, we're just not listening to them. And I've had people come in, and when it comes to movement, they just don't believe their body's capable. I mean, I'm always amazed at folks who come in, because I regularly work with people who are in the process of or have gone through eating disorder recovery and have been very dismissed by health and wellness, traditional health and wellness spaces because they're in larger bodies. And so despite eating disorder history, they're told to lose weight as the answer to their pain, which I also have a major issue with. And they'll come in and say, I have no strength, I have no balance, I'm really weak, and then I'm like, okay, let's test all those hypotheses, and then have them do a bunch of stuff, and I'm like, all right, so where's the part where you show me that you actually can't, you're not strong, you don't have balance. And I think a lot of it is a learning process for the first, 4 to 6 weeks of kind of aligning the perceptions you have about what your body is actually capable of, and the reality of what's showing up in your body. And they're often just really far apart from each other. And so the very first thing, I think the hardest hurdle for getting a person active who has been in a chronic pain situation and inactive but desires to get active, the very first hurdle is reconnecting those two pieces and helping them believe their body's actually capable of it. After that, it's like, it's not about which exercises you do. Like, that's not the hard part. The hard part is being able to face your pain and your fear experience head on and uncover like what's at the root of it, and then being willing to take the steps into the fear, kind of step into the mouth of the fear. And sometimes the fear is, I'm going to do this movement program, and I'm going to learn my body's not capable. And it's like scary to be let down by your body when you feel like your body let you down so much because you have this history of disordered eating or weight cycling that has led you to believe your body is no good. Like, I think we send them a really unhealthy message to people that if they can't achieve like a very rigid idea of what health is, that there's no good, there's no value in their physical body, and then by default their human value. And that's really unfortunate. So that's a lot to unpack for people.
I find that interesting because in my brain, weight is one thing. Your ability to balance that weight or lift other weights is something totally separate. So even a person in a larger body, they learn balance. I mean, all of us have to do it, and some of us maintain it better than others. If you've lost it, you relearn it. Same with strength. It's about the muscles that you build. So, yeah, I really see now what you mean about the diet culture because it's just full of negative messages.
Yeah, and I think again, it depends on where in your lifespan it hit at, like at what stage in your development, how integral it became to your sense of identity, and where it may have actually turned you off from movement altogether for a long period. Because not moving will definitely make your balance and your strength deteriorate, right? So, and that's why, like, I always come back to, well, the goal here is to move. So, like, that's the point, at least from my lens, is that people have maintain or maybe even expand the movement repertoire they have, because it only gets harder to do that. And I want people to be able to have an independent life as long as they can. And people have felt traditionally that they're not welcome in a lot of spaces where movement is the focus if they don't fit a certain mold. And that's where I think in the health and wellness world, we've sort of failed. Because if we're not making movement feel welcoming and accessible to everyone, like, who are we helping?
Just as an aside, I lead exercise classes with elderly women, and I
Love
mean
it.
elderly in their 80s and 90s. And, we might take the summer off and they come back and they notice within a month or two the changes and the development, like the move forward movement of their balance, of their flexibility, of their strength. And I try to show them things they can do at home. If we're going to take 2 months off, keep doing this stuff at home. Just be safe. So it's nice to know that, yeah, it's not like you reach an age. And I think that's another fallacy is
Yes.
like, grandma's on a rocker now. I always say this grandma's off her rocker.
Yeah. No, the human body is adaptable. I mean, if given new challenges, it will adapt and forever, really. I mean, unless, of course, you have like a condition that's, neurologically makes muscle development not possible. I mean, that's obviously a possibility, but like for most average humans, you load a muscle, it grows at all ages. It's not like you reach a point and you're at expired milk and it just doesn't happen anymore, So yeah, I love what you're doing.
I'm going to tell my women that they're not expired milk. They'll have a good chuckle out of
Please, please do.
that one. Okay, so it stands to reason there's an emotional cost to chronic pain.
Oh yeah.
What's the difference between the mental and the emotional with pain?
Oh boy, you're really coming at me with the tough ones today. Well, I think if I'm following your question correctly, I think there's an element of trying to separate what you're physically experiencing from the kind of the data, right, of what's actually happening in our body. And I think in order to make progress, it's really important that we use facts and we inform ourselves about what's really going on. Because I think there can be, even imaging can be problematic. You get an MRI back. You take anybody off the street and put them in an MRI machine, they probably have something going on. But sometimes, we'll have MRIs and then we don't get a really good follow-up, and then you end up walking around being like, I have degenerative disc disorder, like I'm bedridden for the rest of my life, So I think there's sort of a methodical component to like understanding, okay, what is actually in my control right now, and what is actually happening in my body, and what do I actually know about what I'm capable of, and then also what are the beliefs I'm carrying that are informing my choices about movement, and is my choice about movement really informed by the facts, or is it informed by my fear that pain will result, or my fear that I'm going to find myself stuck on the floor and I can't get up, or my fear that I'm going to be in a situation I can't get out of. And then I would say the emotional is sort of, that's in like the body keeps the score territory. Like that's sort of what you might be carrying in your body from a trauma perspective. What are some of the triggers that may be bringing up feelings or old senses of insecurity or anxieties or fear or stresses, or even people pleasing has been found to be connected to chronic pain. And being able to remove those factors, or at least mitigate those factors in a pain situation, usually requires the help of someone really trained in that area. So a psychotherapist who can work on that. I mean, like I have a client, for example, who has, I don't remember the exact term, but she had a couple of concussions in a row, and so she's having like a prolonged kind of concussive response in her body. And so we're working on movement to help her feel stronger. But because it was a pretty big fall from a rock climbing wall, there are certain things we do that instill quite a lot of panic. So I'm like, you have to kind of talk to somebody about what's coming up for you when you try to do some of this stuff, because I can see that it's really distressing for you. And like, we're never going to be able to move forward on helping you feel strong and confident in all situations until we also address the sort of the grief and the trauma and the fear that like is coming up as a result of what was a really terrible experience. So it often requires a team-based approach. I can kind of, and that's what's interesting about my role because I'm not a clinician, but I'm often like the first point of contact. Because maybe folks have tried a lot of other things and they're kind of sick of dealing with doctors, or maybe they just aren't even aware that they're technically a chronic pain candidate. Like they're just like, oh, I'm kind of sore, so you know, maybe everything's fine. But then we start to get underneath like where the pain's coming up, and it turns out like, oh, we actually have a lot of other stuff to deal with. And so then I would kind of refer out to partner clinicians who can help in those areas. But a lot of times we have to really go deep in different parts of a person's life because the body keeps the score, as Professor Van der Kolk says.
The body keeps the score. Yeah, I'm wondering too if, there's that part of your brain that says, here's the logic. This has happened, this is what's going on, and that. And then there's the other part of the brain, which is maybe the part that we need to override that says, I can't do anything anymore, or I'm useless, I whatever, and to try to figure out which part of the brain is yelling the loudest and make sure it's the more logical part of the brain.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's also there's probably there's just getting what you're feeling down. First of all, like even knowing what we're feeling is like half the battle, right? I mean, sometimes it's just kind of panic and we don't know where it's coming from. So getting it all down on paper is one thing. And then and this, you know, I do try to go through this process with people, and it's in the book like this too, to kind of, okay, let's unpack the stories one at a time. Like there's a story you tell yourself, which is, I love walking my dogs, but I can't do it anymore. And it's like, well, why? You know, why? Why ask five the five whys or whatever? And you know, it's like, do you have data that supports this idea that you can't walk beyond, you know, two blocks? Like, is that real? Or are like, have you ever done it and not had pain? Sometimes we can get to the answer by asking, like, do you have an example of this actually being successful? Like, instead of telling me all the times of when you're like, it reinforced your bias that you can't do a thing. Do you have any examples of when you could do the thing? And then sometimes it's informed also by just our beliefs. Like, my mother was bedridden at a certain age, and therefore, like, that will be me. I have my family has a history of XYZ, and therefore, that will be me. So I think that's hard too, right? Or like, we see people around us going through things, and so we use that to inform our own experience. Yeah, it's definitely difficult to separate the facts from the reality. And it's, especially because the emotional part, the fear-based part, they can be pretty noisy, to your point.
I have the opposite example where I had 3 kids in 3 years, was feeling totally unfit, had been a cow for 5 years, and decided to get into fitness. And at home one evening, I had to reach for something that was in an awkward position. And it was like this whole, oh my goodness, like, how am I going to do this? I can't reach it properly. You've got to sort of semi-squat and reach sideways. And I did it. And this was after I'd started this whole getting fitter, healthier, stronger. And I remember that feeling of elation. That was 30 some odd years ago. And I still remember the feeling of elation
Amazing.
of, I just did it. Woo. And being so, I can't even explain just that inside feeling of, oh my goodness.
Yeah, and I think not everyone is able to see the bright spots, and that's why working with a coach of some kind, having or a partner, or having like a supportive friend, you know, I think your accountability structures are also really important. Because not everybody can see that for themselves, or can see the progress even, or see or help you celebrate small wins.
So, as in many other parts of life, you need to look at what you can do, not what you can't do.
Yes, 100%.
Okay. What is stress resilience?
So stress resilience is, well, first of all, it's mostly because I don't like the term stress management. But stress resilience is looking at your life holistically, trying to see how stress plays a role in it. I believe that we don't do enough of recognizing the fact that stress is in the environment. I think we have a tendency to put a lot of individual blame on people for the way that they respond to stress. When again, stress in our bodies, when it shows up in our bodies, however that, that materializes differently for everyone, right? Stress, like pain, is a result of a functioning nervous system that is being triggering something, and to have flight a fight or flight response in your body for whatever reason, and you're being called into action. Again, that tiger chasing you response. And the problem is that, we have not really evolved to this speed that our information and technology have expanded exponentially in terms of the demands they place on our brains. So I think we need to do more acknowledging the fact that the environments we live in are just stressful by default, right? So if we accept that it's not the individual's fault that they feel an experience that could be described as stress, it's like understanding, what do I need to do? Again, understanding those precursors, like what are the signs, the early signs that my body is having a negative reaction to stress or feeling overstimulated by stress? And how do I prevent that kind of spike or kind of getting out of, how do I bring more balance basically into my life? And also, how do I learn to demand, because you deserve to have the right to have balance? And I think, as women, we have often been, shamed for having empathy and sensitivity and compassion and having stress show up in emotional ways, when in fact, again, those are very natural responses. And so I think changing the language we use to understand that creating boundaries is a self-care act, and it may be a swimming upstream in circles. You have a right to demand that you have an environment, or you can control your environment to whatever degree that's possible. Young moms, might not have that feeling a lot of the time, but to feel whole and to acknowledge that the world is a lot, and that you have to do what you need to do in order to feel safe inside it. So resilience is sort of like, stress resilience is an overall strategy that tries to take the blame away from the person, in a way that I think stress management kind of is like, oh, you just don't have the right toolbox to be successful. So it's you need to learn a thing to be better at managing stress. And I think all we really need to learn is what's inside. I think we have all the tools we need, like all the signs and all the information we need about what is going to keep us feeling whole and well is inside us. We just need to learn to tap into it, and also to demand that the world gives us a chance to tap into it in the way that we need.
I talked to someone recently who said, like with stress, adversity, all those things, is you make the two columns, what's in my control, what's not in my control. And when you've got your two lists, you literally rip it in half, and everything that's out of your control, you put in the recycle bin. And then you start working on that which is in your control. I sort of thought that was a possibility for a lot of people.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and the thing that's just one of the kind of positive proof points is that most of the things that are really stress creating in our lives are out of our control. And that's why they are so stressful. And so figuring out how we manage that, like how we, again, women are usually inherently community builders. And so leaning on our community, on our networks. And sometimes as we age, I think it can be more natural to be isolated, to feel isolated and kind of serving the needs of your family or your job and kind of not reaching out and connecting to each other. But I think that we're going to do so much better as a community if we lean on each other, because we have a lot to offer, and there's like a natural soothing and comforting that comes from that.
Two thoughts there is, first of all, that I think most women are really good at that, reaching out and creating and keeping community. The other thought is a piece of advice that I heard a few years ago, and I just thought it was perfect, is that no is a full sentence.
100%. Yep.
So I thought that was great. Now, you say there's three things people with chronic pain should do to find relief. Are you going to share that with us?
Are you talking about
I
the
don't know. It
interview
was
that I
one of your
did, or
talking points. I like
yeah, oh
some of your
boy.
talking points.
Yeah. If it's the one I'm thinking that it is. So, I mean, I think the first thing is recognizing that movement is at the heart of finding relief. So, like, I would never sell myself as like a healer or someone who promises that pain is going to go away. So, I think, as we talked about before, pain is part of a well-functioning nervous system. You would never want to be a person who doesn't experience pain because your life expectancy would be very short. So, what we need to do is get to a point where we make pain as neutral a sensation as we can, rather than something that stokes that like fear-based response. And one of the really important things that we can do that is to prioritize movement. So I think that the biggest hurdle is figuring out how to get active to begin with. And so the kind of three-part thing that I talk about is, first, we have to figure out why we're trying to move. I think that we get a little bit like lost sometimes when we say, it's like, why do I eat broccoli? You know, it's like, you know, you need to move. And so it feels silly to try and come up with a why. But you had someone else on here who was talking about, you know, can you pick up your 4-year-old, you know,
Oh, I
grandson or
use that line a
whatever?
lot. I use, yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, that's a great why, and it's actually a why that comes up a lot in my sessions with people. But people often don't feel like they can say that first. You know, they feel like it, again, getting back to that diet culture point, they think it has to be about, you know, changing their shape or size or something like that. And no, your why is needs to be like, okay, what am I doing this for that really gives me joy? And maybe it's your dogs, or maybe it's your grandkids, or it's some hiking the Cinque Terre that you've always wanted to do. And then you have to come, I would recommend that you come up with 3 to 5 movements that you can do every day that feel really su super safe and soothing to your body. Doing them with re repetition will both build confidence in your body, and it will also become sort of a go-to for your nervous system. Like, the nervous system likes rituals. Like, I love the ritual that you described in the morning. That's a perfect example. And the morning is a time when we often feel kind of stiff. So having things that move your body in all directions. One of the things that happens as we get caught up in our lives is sometimes, you know, when we're younger, we're kind of running and throwing ourselves everywhere. We're experimenting with different movements, and that doesn't really happen as we get older and we kind of go to our jobs and do the same thing. So making sure you're not just going forward and back, you're going side to side, you're twisting, and you're moving everything in all directions. And so I talk about these as being refuge movements. So they're things that you can go to without even having to think about it, of things that will soothe your body, and even if you're in pain, you can do them and you know that they'll be comforting to you. And that is kind of your baseline. And then you need to find things that challenge you. And ideally, these are things that challenge you that get you to your why. Things that challenge you might be getting on the floor and getting back up again. It might be going up the stairs, especially with load if you're carrying a child to bed. So then you don't suddenly decide, okay, I'm just going to start getting on the floor and getting up again. But you figure out, like, what's an incremental thing that I can do that challenges me towards that goal? And maybe that's like sitting and standing up again, or like getting on one knee and getting up again. And initially, I would actually go after the things that really your brain says, I can't do that. You like, I feel like every time I have someone react in my studio with, I can't do that, I go hone in on that, because that whatever that is, whatever the brain is reacting that way, that's exactly the place where we need to be with movement to break that cycle. So you want to always be trying to reach towards what they call your reach movements, like something that is a little bit of a challenge that gets you to your why. And then that little cycle is self-fulfilling, because you're focused on your why, so you're more likely to remember your refuge, your daily routine. You do your daily routine, it gets easier, it becomes natural, it becomes like habitual, and now you're like, oh, I'm feeling kind of confident. You're feeling that confidence, and so you decide to start working on your reach movements, and then maybe you're working on it, it's kind of hard, but then you have that little moment of, oh my gosh, I just half squatted down and reached for the bottle or whatever it was, and I can't believe I did that. You make sure you celebrate it, and then you're more excited to, your why seems more in reach, right? You're like, oh, my why is on the horizon. I can visualize myself doing that hike now, you know? So then you feel more confident, you challenge yourself even more, you have even more wins, you get even more emboldened, you go back, you know. So then it just becomes like this little, you know, 1, 2, 3 that keeps building on itself. And I find that people, it's like, while it may be slow to start, really, it builds on itself really fast.
And what I'm hearing you say too is you've got to acknowledge the wins.
Yes, 100%.
Yeah. Now, I just want to clarify one thing is the bottle is never out of reach, but I will celebrate by opening it and pouring a glass.
There are some things we have to make easy.
There you go. Okay, you are a proponent of Pilates. Tell us what Pilates is and how you use it or why it works for your clients.
Yeah, so Pilates is a set of exercises developed by Joseph Pilates in the early 1900s-ish time frame, but it's also combined with a set of equipment. So I particularly love working with the equipment with people in pain. So there are many pieces of equipment. They are all spring loaded so that they have various forms of resistance. And various forms of resistance that are very adjustable so that they can go in all kinds of directions. So what I love about that when it comes to working with people in pain is that I can change the relationship to gravity in like a multitude of ways so that a thing that feels scary while you're standing up suddenly feels less scary when you're lying down, but I'm activating the same muscle movement so that when I move you into a vertical position, for example, all of a sudden you're like, your brain goes, oh, I know this one. You know, we did this pushing with the springs, but now you're vertical. And it's like, it makes it easier to kind of get over that hump of like, I'm afraid I'm going to fall if I do a thing. So the springs are great because they both add resistance. I would never say it's the equivalent of doing heavy lifting, which I would always encourage women, especially, to do to build that muscle mass and the bone density. But it is resistance and it will tone your body. But the other use of the springs is actually to help offload body weight. So for folks who are, you know, maybe the impact of trying to stand after, like, I work with a lot of knee and hip replacement folks. So it might not be feasible for you to stand on one leg and do something with load right away. But I can take some of your body weight away, and now all of a sudden it feels a little bit more feasible. And so I like it because it gives me that chance to kind of incrementally challenge you without throwing you like right from the pool into the ocean when it comes to kind of growing skills. And we can, you know, we can add in stability and challenge balance. And, you know, I think it's just a really versatile set of equipment and movements that's excellent. And also, I mean, there's very little joint strain because of the nature of springs versus like a free weight. So people can really strengthen and do the work of Pilates through their whole lifespan.
That's super interesting because I always imagined, I've never been to a Pilates class, and I always imagined it was just a style of dance aerobics or something like that. So that's really interesting because I do love equipment.
Yeah, so I mean the Pilates mat I think is, you know, is that's a format, and in fact a lot of the equipment was created because Pilates mat was so hard. He created pieces of equipment. He was really an innovator, honestly, and he created a pieces of equipment to make it so that you could, for example, roll you down and roll back up again, which is very difficult for your abdominals and your back. But do it with a bar in your hands with a spring so that you're kind of learning to do it with a little bit of a support on the way back up. So he came up with all kinds of ways for people to get better at doing the things that you were doing on the mat, which is just your body weight and no help. So I think a lot of the mat is just obviously easy to move around, and so that is probably more popular or more common. But the full Pilates enchilada includes a whole set of equipment.
You need to market that, the
The
Pilates
Pilates enchilada. Yeah, I'm coming up with stuff left and right over
There you
here.
go. Okay, so I was going to ask how you start clients out, but that sounds like probably the most obvious way is because you can gear it back so much and find their starting point and then work from there.
Yeah, I mean, I try to work within sort of that range of comfortable, safe movements, and I do try to add resistance as soon as possible. Like, I think one of the things that teachers do that's an error, in my opinion, is to not challenge people right away. I think they see that someone is hurting, and so they assume they're fragile. And that's also an assumption I had about myself. It's something people have about themselves. And so I think as soon as I do try to push people to their edge as much as possible in a non-scary way, so that they really kind of really start to adapt quickly to the idea of themselves as being strong. But yeah, because I can create ways to do resistance without strain. It's really, we kind of work and then we expand the repertoire into different ways of being in gravity, basically.
Right. Now, you also say that your practice is weight neutral. Explain that for our listeners, because it's just fabulous.
Yeah, so I don't believe in weight loss being a discussion inside my four walls. I don't allow people to negatively speak about their bodies, or I will stop them if they do. I mean, obviously, we all have our feelings. It's not like I'm like gonna chastise them, but I try to create a habit of not allowing negative self-talk or that kind of, negative group talk that can happen when we get in a room in a group class and someone, might join in to some like negative body talk. And so I really make sure people understand that like weight loss is not going to be a goal and that I don't have any mirrors in my studio. I want them to feel the movement in their bodies. I want them to do the movement because it feels good to them. And yeah, we keep weight out of the conversation. And so for folks who are seeking weight loss, it's just not a place for them. So yeah, I want people to understand what they're getting themselves into.
Okay, so you've just released a book. I love the title. You're Meant to Move: A Guide to Conquering Chronic Pain, Increasing Stress Resilience, and Reclaiming an Active Life. And yes, I just, for everybody out there, I had to read that. Tell our listeners about your book.
So yeah, thank you. The book is about really it starts with my story of chronic pain and how I began in this journey. And the goal of the book was really to make my approach to movement available outside the studio because I can only really work one-on-one with so many people, and I'm obviously located in Boston. But I really wrote it in such a way that you could do it week by week. It would take 13 weeks, and then there's like a 14th kind of final week to go through the exercises. And they're usually journaling exercises and relating to different parts of the kind of biopsychosocial model of pain, how that relates to the story we tell ourselves about movement, and then how to design a movement program for yourself. So by the end, you have a movement program for yourself that is, here's my refuge movements I'm going to do every day. Here's my why. Here's my reach movements that I'm going to kind of build up to, and you would probably adjust over time. And throughout this, the weaving of the story, I put in different client vignettes of experiences people have had and that I've worked with, and even their own words. Many of my clients contributed to share their encouragement to the readers of the book. And yeah, so it's kind of a journey that I hope people go on and find that they get some value at the end for their that helps them fall back in love with moving their bodies.
Okay, so I would love to come work with you in Boston, but that's not quite a reality. You also have virtual options, don't you?
I do. Yes. I work virtually with several people, actually. It's usually my express Pilates session, so it's a shorter session. And I also have mat classes 4 times a week, restorative Pilates mat. That is some of your kind of standard Pilates work, but also incorporates mobility and breath work and kind of affirmative language to help it be just a really nourishing movement experience. And those are 4 times a week virtually and in studio.
Okay. Where do we find you on the World Wide Web?
Yes, you can find me at movementremedies.org. I have a weekly newsletter with research, and that's a great way to stay in touch with what's happening at the studio. And I'm also on Instagram at movement_remedies. And I also have a YouTube channel as well with some mat classes and some weekly mo I do weekly Monday motivations to help with the stress resilience too.
Okay, so I know your book is at the website. You offer a free movement assessment. What's that?
So that is my classic just starting session for anybody who starts working with me. So it could be something that we do as a way to start working together, or it could just be like something that you take with you. But basically, we would go through your symptoms and what you're experiencing, what your goals are, and then I would lead you through kind of tests of various, strength and balance and mobility possibilities, and then I would make a recommendation of what you could go and do on your own or what we could do together.
Okay. Before we close, can I ask you a personal question?
Yes.
Cha-cha?
Yes. Are you inviting me to cha-cha?
No, I want to hear more. It's not your usual dance form.
Yeah, God bless my husband. I mean, I'm very appreciative that he was willing to learn the cha-cha with me. We do some other ballroom, but the cha-cha is my favorite. I've loved to dance since I was young, and so it was really a joy to return to some dance through ballroom. And something about that hip swivel just really gets me going. So I love the cha-cha.
And how often do you get out? Like, is this a regular thing, a date night?
We do a weekly class with a trainer. So and you know, if we've visited Puerto Rico and they have some street music, we'll definitely be on the sidewalk, but not so much out in the clubs. Just we do it as a class together.
That's great. And what better way to also stay healthy than
Yeah,
incorporating dance? Yeah.
absolutely. Dance is great for the heart and the body. So
And the mind. It's hard
yes,
to be grumpy when you're dancing.
correct.
Okay. Website link is in the show notes, and all the links are on your page at our website. Listeners, talk to us about your pain journey. You can do that where you're listening, or if you're listening at the Boomer Woman's podcast at boomwithabang.com, scroll to the bottom of the page and talk to us there. Or what question should I have but didn't ask DK? Ask it in the comments and I'll get you an answer. Every week I ask you to leave stars and reviews. They really do help with the reach of this podcast. Thank you. And share this episode. I mentioned early on that by this age, we've probably had a few run-ins with physical pain. They may still haunt us. Now, DK, while I'm thinking about this, is we talked about the emotional ramifications of physical pain. Do you ever discuss the physical ramifications of emotional pain? Because
Oh,
that's got to be a thing.
it is a thing. Yeah, I mean, again, I think that's where I would refer to a psychotherapist or someone to really help them address that. But I certainly do on a high level to say, you know, just so you know, if you're going through a difficult time, it's very common for past pain symptoms to show up again at a time of stress and, you know, physical or emotional duress.
Can the
So
body inflict like new pain because it's so stressed and things are so upset within the heart and soul and brain that it just creates pain wherever?
sure. I mean, sure. I think, yeah, I mean, you could have a lot of people will have like non-specific back pain, which is sort of, it kind of migrates, you know, around the body, around the low back in particular. That just seems to be a place that kind of pain shows up. But I mean, there's a whole booklet of, I'm not going to get it correctly, but psychophysiological pain disorders or whatever, that where they're kind of pain conditions that we know are really connected to nervous system duress and probably emotional, psychological duress, and have since resulted in a physical symptom.
As I was asking you that question, I realized that so often we carry our stress nobody else can see me, but our shoulders come up and we sort of close our body in. And when you hold that position for days, weeks, months, it's got to create aches and pains and things like that.
Yeah, and I mean, I would even differentiate like muscular tension from carrying stress in a postural way from just really traumatic events that show up as physical pain, not because we held something physically, but just because the nervous system experience, you know, like I'm thinking of like a veteran or like someone who's gone through something really traumatic, you know, it may materialize as physical pain, and it has nothing to do with anything physical that happened. It's just the nervous system feels you're unsafe.
This is why you're on the podcast. Okay, listeners, share this episode. If you've dodged the pain bullet, I'm willing to bet you have family and friends who have not, and they will appreciate the share. DK Ciccone, thank you for being my guest today and joining the dots between pain, resilience, movement. I really appreciate it.
Was my pleasure. Thank
Have
you.
a great rest of the week.